Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I want to start by talking about the relative places that the clubs were in 1990, but Mark Bright and Gary O'Reilly were jumping up and down when they heard Pavarotti there. Why are you so excited?
Once you get to the semi-final, right, you have to sit there in a hotel the night before a game, and all of a sudden there's whisperings, aren't there,
It's Mark? A posh hotel, presumably on the outskirts of London, somewhere.
We were absolutely in Solihull. What's the name of the hotel?
It's called the New Hall.
New Hall.
Right, okay.
So all of a sudden...
I love the way he turns to his Midlands correspondent to get the news there. Yeah.
No, I couldn't remember the name of the hotel. It had a moat round it, I think.
Yes.
Anyway, the day of the game...
Let's keep you in, guys.
There's a rather...
yes, probably a good idea. Curfews and stuff. There's a rather large man in reception that happened to be Luciano himself. Yeah.
Oh, incredible.
And all of a sudden, Stan Ternent's there, and all of a sudden, the Pavarotti posse start to push him away because he's got his pre-match isotonic Woodbine going. And the big guy does not allow smoke around him when he's about to perform. So that was a one. And he's a big football fan.
Can you remember what was said? Stan was a former coach at the club.
Yeah.
And Steve had invited him to come down to the semi-final, and he's smoking, and somebody said, "Excuse me, could you put the cigarette out? Because Pavarotti's coming through, doesn't like smoke." And Stan said, "Tell him go the other way."
Listen, guys, what I want to talk about in this
first
section...
By the way, we love Stan.
I was going to say, before you're going to say we love Pavarotti.
We do, but we love Stan, yeah.
Let's talk about the relative places the two clubs were in, Liverpool and Crystal Palace, at the start of and during this season, 1989-90. Gary Gillespie, if I might start with you, I find myself almost impossible to say this, but there are people now young enough, Gary, who don't believe what a huge, successful, invulnerable, undefeatable club Liverpool were in those days.
Well, we were probably what Man United is today, if not even better. I think I joined the club in 83-84 and left in 91, and we finished no worse than second.
Gary,
I think
I've got it written down here. In the previous 17 seasons, coming up to this season, Liverpool finished first or second in 16 seasons out of those 17. And you were, of course, holders of the FA Cup as well.
Yeah, it was a frightening record, and I think the only sad thing about that, and especially the team that, you know, from 87-88, was, you know, we were banned from European football, so we never figured against the really best to test us. But the record is phenomenal, and I think being the cup holders going into that season, I think the onus at Liverpool was always on the league. The cup was a bonus, but the league was always the number one priority, and I think that was always the goal at the beginning of the season. But certainly, if the cup get, you know, the further you get in the cup competitions, the more you want to win, and certainly being cup holders, and the disappointment of missing out against Arsenal the season before in the last game of the season, you know, that always gives you that little bit of impetus and that little bit extra desire to go and do better the next year, and that was what Liverpool was all about.
Gary, remind me, were you on the pitch for Arsenal's victory?
I'll tell you where I was.
I'm going to put you on my list of people to blame if you're
shock horror. I was actually injured, and I was sat up in the stand, and there was about, obviously, there was 2 minutes to go, and I literally got up from my seat in the stand, ran down the stairs through the back, through the main stand, and literally as I was walking down that iconic, the stairway down where you see this is Anfield sign, and I was literally just getting up the other side, and Michael Thomas was going through on Bruce Grobbelaar, and he put the ball in the back of the net. I was all ready to celebrate, you know, another league championship victory, and then the ball goes into the back of the net, 2-0, and obviously the whole place, other than the Arsenal fans, was deadly silent. The guys were strewn on the pitch, and it was devastating, to be honest with you.
I work here with Ray Houghton, and I'd consider him a friend these days. I still think he should have brought Michael Thomas down as he went through the centre circle.
Probably. I think Stevie Nicol played centre back that day, and all I was saying was that had I been playing,
that would never have happened.
Exactly, yeah, we would have won.
Guys, do you know what, Danny? That is still the best end to any... I know the Aguero thing was sensational last year, but that was first against second, and whoever won would have won the title. So to me, that's still the greatest finish to a
season. You have to remember that we only lost that in goal difference as well. And the amount of fixtures that we actually had to play at the end of the season, I mean, nowadays it just wouldn't happen. You know, obviously because of the Hillsborough thing.
These two are miming. I should make the point, Gary, you're in a remote studio. These two are miming violins now, Gary.
Yeah.
Listen, guys, we've got about a minute before, during this section, to talk about where Crystal Palace were an emerging force rather than a dominant force like Liverpool at this stage. Steve Coppell started to put together a pretty good team. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think so. Promotion the season before.
You and Ian Wright up front.
Yes.
Though Ian was hurt, he got his leg broken some stage.
Ian had broken his leg for the second time during the season, so he was out for the semi-final. We were sort of a team of misfits. I mean, I got there slightly before Gary. Gary came just after me. Yeah. Jeff Thomas, John Pemberton.
Gary came cuts with a fire sale at Spurs.
No, at Brighton.
Brighton, rather. Yeah.
I tell you what it were. We were a bunch of mongrels that had the audacity to push their way into Crufts and cause an upset. Players with points to prove.
Yes, that's
players.
What
players
did.
Who had emerging potential. Anyone who's a big fan of Moneyball and Sabermetrics, yeah. I think between them, Ron Nodes and Steve Coppell probably just about invented it. They went out and sourced. We had players like Steve Claridge coming into the club. We had players like Stan Collymore, in and around this period, come into the club. Players from non-league.
So what they call characters as well. Yeah.
Well, yeah. But Steve guys who would do it.
Steve got rid of the experienced players and got everyone roughly about the same, so there was no hierarchy in the dressing room. We were all about the same age. Probably Gary was probably the most experienced in terms of top flight appearances. I'd been at Leicester, but I hadn't played very much. So, yeah, hungry, young, mid-20s, ambitious players.
Gary Gillespie, we're going to be hearing a lot of gloating from these two as the rounds go on and we get to semi-final, but I think we should talk about the league that season, 89-90. My memory is that there was a game at Anfield between Liverpool and Crystal Palace where the team shared 9 goals, but they were shared rather unevenly.
Yeah, it was Liverpool against the Crystal Palace mongrels that you like to call
9-0,
yourselves.
9-0, Gary.
9-0. And
say it again, go on.
It was quite funny, actually, because I was doing a game
for you.
No. I was doing a game for LFC TV just the other day there at under 21 game. Liverpool were playing Tottenham, and Perry Suckling's actually involved in. Must be the goalkeeping coach for the Spurs reserves.
He is.
And he came and introduced himself, and I always have a laugh every time I see him. That he was a goalkeeper on that day, and I think after that game, the lads will probably correct me if I'm right. He never played for Crystal Palace again, and none of the goals were his fault.
And I think, Gary, am I right in saying that you actually scored?
I scored the fourth goal, I think, diving header near post from a corner, but it was well gone by then.
Memories of that great day at Anfield, guys?
Nah. Perry did play. He played.
They both played as well.
No, Gary, let's be fair. We were out there.
There's no way
you can say you played.
I'll ask you because, I mean, Gary would have been in the thick of the action, but you must have had a good spectator's view of the game from about 40 yards away.
Righty and me. After a few goals, Wrighty said, "How many is that?" And I said, "I'm not sure." Said, "How many is that, ref?" And the ref did that on his pad.
No.
He went 1, 2, 3, 4, strike 5, 1, 2, 7. Cork, dear.
It was actually eight different goal scorers as well.
Yes, it was unique.
That was Aldo's last game for Liverpool.
That's right.
And he comes on as a substitute with his first touch, takes a penalty. Mm. And I'm looking at him. And I'm going, "You rotten so-and-so."
Yeah.
And I remember screaming, there's no way we go home with it in double figures. And I just turned to Aldo and said, "I never thought in my life I'd ever say that during a game."
Well, do you know, Jeff Thomas missed a penalty as well.
Did he?
Blazed one over. Blazed one over. And after the game, we came off. Steve just did this short speech about that'll never happen to you again in your professional football career. Get washed, changed. We're on the coach. Don't say nothing to the press. I'll do the talking. Let's get out of here. So Jeff Thomas was saying that he was in the bath at Anfield and Pembo came in.
John Pemberton.
Right, and Pembo sort of jumped in the bath and that and looked at Jeff, he said, "I tell you what, they'll do something this year. They're decent, aren't they?"
Yeah, well done, John Pemberton. Football
highlight
extraordinary.
Oh, no, it's gallows humour. Do you know what? That, if you look back at that game, and congratulations to Liverpool, because at that time, they were as good as it gets. I mean, I played against the early 80s version of Liverpool, and they were splendid. And I put them in the same category.
88, 89, 90, those Liverpool teams were unbelievably dominant.
But for us, that was the watershed. No pun intended on the bath thing. But for us, after that moment, I think that was it. We were tagged Virgin soldiers. We were given dogs abuse. Yeah. And when you get done 9-0, rightly so.
Because you're wearing the Virgin
absolutely.
Yeah.
So from there onwards, all of a sudden it was right. This is what it's going to take. This is where it comes together. And it took a little while, but you could definitely see that thing growing.
And you got your revenge at Sellers Park when you only lost 2-0.
Yeah. Work in progress, as I was saying.
It's very difficult to explain, but, you know, to when people say, Twitter now, because you can relive everything. People post all the YouTube, etc. And they say, oh, you got beat 9-0. He said, do you realise how good Liverpool were at that stage?
I grew up
with the Liverpool era, so I can tell you the best teams and the best football, and going there and being nervous about walking out at Anfield and seeing the emblem walking down the tunnel. And it meant something very special then. And that's Manchester United now.
I'll try and put it as I think I'm probably the oldest person there around this table. I believe that at no time during Manchester United's recent dominance have people feared going to Old Trafford the way they feared going to Anfield in the late 1970s.
I think that's a good point. It will be argued, but I think it's a fair point.
Do you know why, Danny? Right. Because I think most teams have better players.
Yeah.
Game winners, match winners in their team. Mm. And I remember Gordon Milne was our coach at Leicester City when I went there with Leicester, and it was Boxing Day or something. Gary Lineker scored. We got hammered. I played up front with Gary, I think, and I can tell you I had about 5 touches, chased and closed, because that's how they kept the ball at the back. And we won 1-0 or something. It was a fluke, and Gordon Milne just said, you know what? Enjoy that, because you might never do that again in your careers, win at Anfield.
And I bet Gordon Moore's no bad judge either.
He was right. Yeah. I've never won there again.
Listen, so I just wanted to get that in for the sake of poor old Gary Gillespie, who's going to have to listen to you two crowing about the semi-final. But it was an example of how the two teams were back in that day. Let's look back at the early rounds now. Guys, Crystal Palace in the third round drew Portsmouth, and I think you won 2-1 at Sellers Park. Do you remember that game?
I think we went behind, didn't we?
You did. Portsmouth led 1-0 at half time.
Was it McLaughlin scored?
Alan McLaughlin scored, yeah. And then Jeff Thomas got a long range volley. And then Andy Gray is going to turn up a lot in this story. Not Aston Villa's Andy Gray, but Andy Gray, a strong, competitive midfielder who never lifted a foot once he got to Spurs, but that's another story.
Andy Gray.
Is that fair?
No, it's not. I'll tell you now, Andy Gray had the potential in him on his day to be as good as it could be in the centre of midfield. He had power, he had pace.
Correct.
He could hit the ball as hard as anyone I've ever seen.
Yeah.
He could shoot from distance. He had a pass in him.
Played for England, Danny.
He did.
Now, five of that Palace team played for England. Mm.
See, that was the work. That was the work in progress.
Was that under Graham Taylor, though, boys?
Carlton Palmer's got 13 England caps. Don't tell me that means anything.
It's relative. It has to be.
The opinion of
the current England manager at that time was, this person fits what I want to do. So, Glenn Hoddle didn't have as many.
And when you say five of that England Palace team went on to play for England, you should bear in mind that I'm saying this in all seriousness.
No, I'm not.
I'm going to say this, and Gary will probably know what I'm going to say.
Yeah.
That was the last All English 11 to make a semi-final or a final of the FA Cup. In fact, an All English 13, if I remember rightly.
David Madden, was it Rudy Hedman?
Rudy was in the semi, and it was Madders and McGoldrick.
All English flags on Wikipedia, if you look anywhere.
I know, I've seen that before.
Gary, you missed a lot of these early rounds because I think Glenn Hussain had kind of started to play in your place, and I also, of course, with all due respect, you were perpetually injured or on the verge of injury. And Liverpool made hard work of the early rounds of this FA Cup, although they drew 0-0 at Swansea. And do you remember the replay?
Yeah, I think the first three rounds, I think we got drawn away from home on each occasion. Swansea was obviously the third round, and it was a 0-0 tie, I think it was. And then Liverpool obviously brought them back to Anfield 3 days later. And
what can only be described as the Crystal Palace treatment.
Yeah, exactly. 8-0. It was comfortable. But, you know, I think it just showed
we were in good company then.
For the teenagers listening, just listen to these are Liverpool's goal scorers that day. And again, there are half a dozen of them. John Barnes, Ronnie Whelan, John Barnes again, a hat-trick by Ian Rush, Peter Beardsley, and then somebody called Steve Nicol, who only got about 80 caps for Scotland. Mm-hmm. An extraordinary team, and you make your way through there for the third round. And the fourth round, which we'll do before the break here, you, Crystal Palace, drew Huddersfield Town at Sellers Park, and it was a bit of a stroll for you, I think.
What was
4-0.
That?
4-0.
Did I get one there?
You did. John Sulaco scored. Jeff Hopkins scored. There was an own goal by a chap called Lewis. But clearly not a very memorable game.
No, it wasn't. Because Well, we kind of scrambled our way a couple of times.
We didn't meet anyone big on our way to the semi-final. All due respect to the clubs that we did.
We'll come on to your lucky fluky draws until you got Liverpool in a little while. Yeah. In Liverpool, as you say, quite rightly, Gary, they drew Norwich at Carrow Road. This says something about this Liverpool team as well. They didn't concede. It was a 0-0 draw at Carrow Road, and then you won 3-1 at Anfield. Goals by Steve Nicol. Robert Fleck equalised for Norwich. And then John Barnes and Peter Beardsley saw Liverpool through again. Try and tell people, I'll start with you, Gary Gillespie. Tell people, though, these early rounds, people didn't mess around with the FA Cup like they do now. Try and tell people just how important this tournament was back in 1990.
Yeah, it was the second, as I say, I think first and foremost, we always regarded the first division, or
the
top flight. That we wanted to win that. But certainly the FA Cup is far more important these days than what it is just now. But I think, you know, any time you went away from home, it was going to be difficult. It was the time of the year, the pitches were nowhere near as good as what they are at this moment in time. And I remember some of the surfaces that we used to play, and we went to York one year and played against York. It was diabolical. There was straw on the pitch because, you know, it was frozen. And the game these days would just not be played. So it was always difficult going away from home. But
can you imagine a sports scientist if you said we're playing on a frozen pitch with straw on it?
But yeah, exactly. Take the positives out of that. But, you know, Liverpool had the mindset really to go away from home and get a result. And they obviously believed that at any time that we took a team back to Anfield, then, you know, we were strong favourites. But it was never easy going away from home, especially in the early rounds in lower league clubs as well. It was their cup final. They would, like, you know, these guys, they'll tell you, the likes of Brighty and Gary O'Reilly, they'll tell you that they play above their level when they're playing against a big side. And Liverpool were always the big attraction. And it really put an extra step in there and their pace. Or, like, they could jump a bit higher, they could run quicker, they could run for longer. So you had to combat that. You had to fight. You had to earn the right to go and play your football. And if it meant, you know, getting a draw away from home and bringing them back to Anfield, then so be it. But Liverpool had that mindset and the strength of character to obviously have the belief that you could do that and still progress in the competition.
That still holds true now. You think about Oldham and their cup run this season. Lower league players will come up and go for it. And it's fair. And the other thing is television. We didn't get this wall-to-wall television we had before. And when the FA Cup gone, you generally got a big slice of it. So young people watching it were that much more enamoured with the FA Cup. And there was that much, probably more emotional connection.
And the players knew they were going to be on national television in a way that they now take for granted. But then it was a big game. Rochdale were then mid-table in the fourth division. I think Rochdale are always mid-table in the fourth division, aren't they? Let's be fair to them. And of course, the fact that clubs like Rochdale continues to thrive is one of the great things about English football. But there they are. And you squeaked through 1-0. Any memories of the game, guys?
I didn't play. I don't know. I broke a nail or I had some split ends or something like that. But I didn't play in that game.
Let's get this right, Gary. I mean, you were always competing for your place that season, were you? There was three of you.
I shared the bed next to Gary in the treatment room, I think. You know,
who else was playing centre-back with you most of that season?
There was Jeff Hopkins. There was Gavin Nedling. Rudy Hedman was around. Andy Thornfield.
And Jeff kind of...
There was Jeff and Andy and myself were probably the three rotating players, well, mainly Jeff and myself, because Andy seemed to be
Andy
first choice.
For every draw, the FA Cup, Wrighty and me used to be at Mitchell Thomas's house in North London. Mitchell's at Spurs then. We just happened to be there for the third round draw. And the third round draw came out.
I dread to think what the three of you were. Except I know you, Mark, to be a decent human being. I can't imagine what the other two are up to, but go on.
I can tell you, Mitch was really supportive of, because obviously, you know, he's at Spurs at the time.
Yeah.
And he said, you'll beat them. You'll beat Portsmouth. And then we went to Mitchell's house again for the next draw.
Okay.
Yeah, then the Hudders. Then we do, it was like a tradition thing. We have to go to Mitchell's
house. But footballers aren't superstitious.
Yeah, no. Honestly. And then when obviously Rochdale come out, Wrighty me went, crying out loud. We've got a chance. We've got a really good chance.
Yeah.
Be in the quarterfinals. And then for the quarterfinal, we'll move on to the quarterfinal draw. But we used to go to Mitch's. And then obviously when we drew Liverpool, Mitch go, yeah, but you've got to play someone decent, and you're somewhere along the way.
He wasn't looking at the aggregate 7-0 result during the course of the season, was he?
Kind of like Liverpool, the best team left in the competition.
Gary Gillespie, I mean, even a team as great as Liverpool, did the players also have superstitions?
Yeah, I think you do. I think players are notorious for having, you know, different...
Yeah, but if you've got the best players, you don't need superstition, do you?
Well, that's true, I suppose. But no, I think every individual has their own idiosyncrasies, like whether you want to put your left boot on last or touch the sign as you're walking down Anfield. I'm just looking at the rounds, actually, when the lads are talking about. They had some really tough ties, didn't they? Portsmouth, Huddersfield and Rochdale.
Yeah, they wonder they liked around Mitchell Thomas's house.
Yeah, incredible that. And I think all at home as well. Like, so you expect maybe to get to the quarterfinals at least. But no, I think we were confident against Southampton, and it was a great result. Any time you get drawn at home in the FA Cup, and I think it's still true today that you obviously fancy chances. And
once again, Gary, the sign that Liverpool not taking the series, but not mocking this tournament at the 3-0, as you rightly say, against Southampton, Ian Rush, Peter Beardsley and Steve Nicol. Again, I forgot that Steve Nicol used to get lots of goals from fullback and midfield.
He did. Yeah. Good goal scorer. Yeah, when he's played with Steve.
He was actually... Stevie Nicol, when you look at his record, it was absolutely phenomenal. What a great player as well. And really...
Underrated in that team.
Very much so. I think when you look back, certainly I've looked back in the past years over like games and clips of him, he was a phenomenal player. And unfortunately, you know, he missed out, obviously, in that semi-final against Crystal Palace.
Did he not win Player of the Year one season, Stevie Nicol?
He did. Indeed.
I mean, how many fullbacks win Player of the Year? So he was, you know, that's the mark for the you judge. Yeah.
He came to Sheffield Wednesday towards the end of his career when I was there, and I mean, excellent finisher. Yeah. Could chip, could
well,
curl,
that's clear.
Could...
He scores in every round. Yeah,
yeah.
Listen, I would say then the quarterfinal draw comes around. Obviously, the smell of the Wembley's in the nostrils of all three of you and your respective clubs. They go around. I presume you go to Mitchell Thomas's house because the draw, Gary, for Crystal Palace is
another tough one, wasn't it?
Well, they could have had Manchester United, Liverpool, Aston Villa. In fact, they drew away to fourth division Cambridge United, the lowest team left in the tournament.
Excuse me. To test for us, we had to leave South London for the first time in this
away?
Competition.
We've been drawn away. Scandalous. And that was, listen, I mean, you pointed out, didn't you, that under John Beckett those days.
I'm going to say something. Yeah, tell us about that Cambridge team, because A, it had some excellent footballers. Liam Daish played, Dion Dublin was in the team.
Correct.
And they went on. They almost reached the Premier League with that team within about 3 years.
Steve Guppy, Claridge was there.
Correct.
Guppy, Daish.
And John Beck, this was when he was throwing the cold water over them before he went on the pitch.
Doing all sorts of other things. What John Beck did, because they had this kind of chicken wire tunnel as you walked out onto the Stad Abbey, and he started to try and do the psychology on the team. Now, the South London boys were like,
really?
You are kidding.
Yeah.
I won't tell you what was said. Needless to say, they were impervious to John Beck's charms.
Yeah.
I missed that game.
Oh.
I missed that game because I'd got sent off. I think it was against
Mark Bright, sent off.
Unbelievable.
Disgrace.
For what? Can you remember?
Two yellows. Oh. And I got sent off.
No, no two tackles, mate. No, I'm not having that. Two tackles from Mark Bright.
One might have been.
He must have had a migraine or something, no, Gary.
One must have been an elbow. It must have been an elbow. I can't remember. But anyway, so Steve Coppell, I had an injury as well, a bit of a hamstring injury. So I'd had an injection. And Steve said to him, if you want to go and get some sun for a few days. So obviously our sponsors were Virgin, and they sent me to Miami. So
nice.
I was in Miami, and I was gutted, Danny, because I thought, if I we am. Go out here, Wrighty's injured. Nobody's. I think Andy Gray played up front. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
So I remember I was, honest to God, I was
John
on the beach.
John Solaco got the late goal.
I was on the beach. No,
no,
he didn't.
It was GT.
Absolutely. Yeah. Sorry. Who got it?
Jeff Thomas.
Okay, yeah.
So
Solaco's goal was ruled out as a late goal. He got the second, but handball.
I was on the beach and I was looking at my watch and I was thinking, right, they must be finished now. So I kind of ran up to the hotel room and I phoned Wrighty's mum. Now, Wrighty's mum used to listen to the radio station for Palace all the time. So I went through this conversation. If you won't have met Wrighty's mum, but she's old school Jamaican. So phone Wrighty's mum. She picked up the phone. And I went, "Mama, yeah, Mark Bright. Hi, what are you doing? How did we go on? Where are you? I'm in America. Where? Miami. How did we go on? What are you doing over there? How did we go on?" It was one of those conversations. And she goes, "Why are you there?" I said, "Because I'm injured. I've got a few days off. Anyway, how did we go on?" She goes, "Jeff Thomas called. We won 1-0. I dropped the phone and did somersaults on the bed. So I just thought, semi-finals, this is it. And I was I kind of like that, really anxious.
Hopefully we'll draw Accrington Stanley, yeah.
See, the thing about Cambridge at the time with John Beck, they did the don't water the pitch thing.
Yeah.
They also sanded in the corners, so long, because they played a very long direct style. Then the ball would hold up in the corners. The ball boys had towels, and everything was geared towards intimidating and trying to destroy the opposition in any way they possibly could.
That would suit you guys, wouldn't it?
But, well, I think we were better at the direct style of play than they were, and therefore we had that 1-0 advantage.
Meanwhile, Liverpool draw away from home. They draw a Queen's Park Rangers side. It's hard to remember. This Queen's Park Rangers side at the time contained the following players. I won't name them all, but it did contain David Seaman, Kenny Sansom, Paul Parker, the late lamented Alan McDonald, Ray Wilkins, Roy Wegerle, Andy Sinton. I could go on. A much tougher draw for Liverpool.
Yeah, I think all these rounds were tough, I think, away from home. Correct me if I'm wrong, Danny, but I think the QPR still have the plastic pitch then as well.
You did play on the plastic pitch, and the bouncy plastic pitch.
It was the worst plastic pitch.
They're playing on sand at Cambridge. You're playing on AstroTurf in West London.
And Brighty's on a beach in Miami. that's great for team spirit, that, isn't it? Yeah. Thanks for the phone call. Anyway, lads. No, like QPR, I think we drew 2-2 down there and brought them back to Anfield again and got the business done with a 1-0 victory. But as you rightly say, QPR, they were a decent side there, and especially down at Loftus Road with that difficult pitch to play on.
Basically, it was a piece of AstroTurf, a bit of green carpet on concrete.
Yeah, that's exactly
and
what
when
it
the
was
ball
like,
bounced, you came off there with neck ache because you just kept looking up. I fell over there once.
I got tripped over, and there was someone from the burns unit from the local hospital came and treated you afterwards with all this plastic skin.
Yeah,
I mean. It was horrific. Yeah.
No, I know. And what you needed, I guess, was a very big, strong centre forward if you're going to play. I know it's Colin Clark's name is on the team sheet.
Colin Clark, Northern Ireland international.
They used to just boot it up to Colin and let him fight for it on that.
But you know what, Danny? For many years, I think QPR might have been London's highest finishing team. I mean, they used to finish above Chelsea all the time.
Yeah, ain't going to happen this year, is it? Now listen,
what a
you.
Cynical note.
No,
it's nothing to do with Spurs. It's just that the amount of money they've spent and the amount of money they are spending and to not win two home games. God almighty. Listen, you're listening to an effort. If by the time this programme goes out, they're suddenly fifth from bottom, I take it all back. Of course, once you get down to the last four, I dare say footballers like fans are studying the three others and thinking, who can we get? You could have had... when the draw was actually made, you could have had Oldham or Aston Villa were still replaying, QPR or Liverpool were still replaying. I suppose you'd have probably wanted to pull the winners of Oldham against Aston Villa if you had a choice, yeah?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
You want to increase your chances to get to the final. But having said that, when we'd won our semi-final game, we went and did a radio show, didn't we? And Man United and Oldham was a replay. And they said, who do you want? And we said, Man United. We kind of wanted the glamour in the final. Whereas, like, at the semis, we kind of... Because we were there.
Yeah.
At the semis, you wanted... Well, if Oldham get through, we want Oldham.
Yeah, bless them. Yeah, of course
you want. It's only natural to think like that as a fan, as a player. It's coaching stuff as well, I suppose.
Gary Gillespie, thinking back, did Liverpool have the same... I mean, presumably, even a team as dominant as Liverpool, you still wanted the easier draw, yeah?
Yeah, we got it, Crystal Palace.
Yeah, absolutely. I understand there was bunting on the gates of Anfield after the draw was made,
Absolutely.
9-0.
We'd be the 9-0 and 2-0 away from home. Who do you think we wanted? I think what you've got to remember that, I mean, you talk about Manchester United, but Manchester United, I think, at that season finished 15th in
the
first
division. Yeah, they were really poor that year.
And Aston Villa came second, actually, to Liverpool.
But isn't there a danger, though, with Manchester United, Gary, that even when they've got a poor team, they can always pull a performance because of the history of the club? Whereas, what did you know about Crystal Palace?
Well, they're always the glamour club, Man United. They've always been, certainly since I've moved south from Scotland, they've always been the glamour club, Manchester United. But in terms of ability and quality, you know, Aston Villa were probably the next best team to Liverpool. But no, I think we were quite happy with the draw, in all fairness. Yeah. As I said before, you know, we'd played them twice that season, won 9-0 at Anfield and obviously 2-0 away at Selhurst Park. So we were quite confident with whoever we actually drew. But Crystal Palace, I think when we looked at that draw, I think we were more than happy with it.
To be fair to Palace... there'd been changes, hadn't there, though? The team that lost 9-0 at Anfield, as you say, never played together again.
Perry Suckling did play after the Anfield
game. Did he?
He did. A couple of days later, we had another away game at Southampton, which we drew. And Perry played. So,
okay, so we don't want to write him back out of history quite so
no,
quickly.
No, don't do that. Get him back in the saddle as quickly as possible. And yeah. I think that was a cathartic experience for everybody to let's try and wash that out straight away. And we were lucky that it came quickly.
I think Gary nailed it where he said that none of the goals were Perry's fault.
No.
When you look back, but it virtually put an end to his career there because Nigel Martin was bought for £1 million by Steve Coppell.
That's an important change, isn't it? You're getting a goalkeeper who goes on to play for England here. And the £1 million might well have been a record for a goalkeeper at the time.
It was
a huge thing, wasn't it?
I think
it was, Bristol Rovers, we picked him up. And a great lad, very calm Cornishman, but talented.
Very.
Without a doubt. I mean, I had the privilege to play, and Gary will know this guy, Ray Clements. I had the privilege to play in front of Ray with my days at Spurs. Mm-hmm. And I would put Nigel a close second in terms of goalkeeping ability Ray himself.
After that 9-0, Danny, Steve Coppell could have gone out and bought a player for any position. Mm. You know, it was that simple.
Did he make any other changes in the team or did he buy any more players? Because this was before the transfer window, wasn't it?
No,
you could just buy people.
Do you know what he did? He realised what he had in the next wave. And if you look back at after that squad, a group of players came through that were astounding. If you think Southgate, Richard Shaw, who'd bumped his way into the first team. The same youth team, Johnny Sulaco was in there. Then you had the likes of Andy Woodman, you got Jamie Murrelly, you had Jimmy Glass. Who am I missing out?
David White.
David White, what a talented striker he was. He was in and around the squad.
Chrissy Powell was in there.
Powell had made his debut before that.
We bought Cookie, but he was considered a youngster.
But in terms of
Chrissy Coleman,
organic growth out of the club, that pool of players was there. Yeah. It didn't have to be brought in.
Danny, to answer you, there was five changes, I think, from the 9-0 game to the semi-final game.
Right.
Obviously, the goalkeeper, Nigel Martin, came in. I think Richard Shaw, who was probably there, but he actually started, didn't he?
Yes. Yep.
Andy Thorne came in, and I think John Sulaco played as well.
And we changed the formation as too, because it wasn't the classic 4-4-2. No. We'd come out, because Ian Wright had been taken out of the equation.
Talk to me about this. When did Ian break his leg? Can you remember?
He broke it twice.
Yeah. In the same season?
Derby County was the game at home.
And he broke it in a comeback against in the reserves.
Was it? Then the Derby County game was the game, I think.
Did I tell you what happened there? So that season, early in the season, I had this hamstring problem, and which led me to having the injection to going away
to Miami,
right, I think it was I went to see this faith healer, it was Steve Coppell, I think the name was Olga Stringfellow, she was in Southampton, and
Stringfellow, you're having a laugh, I mean, are you?
You went to Stringfellows with Steve Coppell, very good, Gary.
And, anyway, cut a long story short, she sort of like did her stuff on me, and I was okay. Sort of lasted to the end of the season. When Wrighty broke his leg, he went to see her as well.
Different proposition, though, isn't it?
Well, totally. But then you know what it's like with you break your leg and the bone parts, and then it forms like a callus around the side of the bone.
Yeah.
And he had an X-ray not long afterwards, and the union had joined, had sealed itself, and obviously everyone knows he played in the cup final, having broke his leg twice, which is virtually impossible. So, you know, he said that when he came back from seeing the Olga Stringfellow, that, you know, he could bang his leg on the side of the table with the plaster on it, didn't hurt. And usually that kills you. And he was adamant. I mean, everybody.
What was he doing, banging his leg on the side of the table
to
anyway?
Make a point, to make a point.
Yeah. But everyone was behind him, and we knew. I mean, when we get to the final, et cetera, it was like Steve had to break his heart and say,
you're on the bench.
Yeah. And right. You could clearly see when he came out from seeing Steve, he'd been crying, but he was a man about it. He didn't want to show the boys he was that disappointed. Wow. Anyway.
I don't know. Gary Gillespie, just a matter of interest. Because it's easy now, but particularly after Eileen Drury, this whole business about going to see homeopathic, non-scientific. Did Liverpool ever have a faith healer or anything like that?
We never had a physiotherapist, never mind a faith healer.
I love that.
The medical side at Anfield was diabolical, I have to say. Looking back, to be honest with you, you just accepted it as part and parcel of the football club. I mean, who was anybody to come in and criticise Liverpool? The European champions won 18 league titles, but we didn't have a qualified physiotherapist. Ronnie Moran and Roy Evans used to give us treatment. And we were sitting in the morning and getting treatment, and Ronnie would be giving us ultrasound.
I'm shaking my head still, I don't believe you. You've no reason to lie to me, but I don't believe you.
Honestly, and he'd be giving you ultrasound on your ankle, you had a bad ankle or something like that, and he'd be reading the paper. paper, and through the first article, you'd be halfway up your leg on your calf, and it was your it was just ridiculous.
Are you sure he wasn't shaving your legs?
Now, the psychology there is that I daren't be injured.
I'm not having the
treatment because this is what I get. I've got no chance. We had a great physio at the time at Crystal Palace, a guy called David West, and as much as Wrighty and Olga did their thing, I think a lot of the credit has to go to David, because he's still young, he is brilliant, absolutely brilliant.
And the new ideas about you know stretching and all that sort of thing, and strengthening, and nobody else had done any of that sort of thing.
He was way ahead of the curve. When John Sulaco got his knee badly smashed up, David whipped him straight out to California to put a dead man's Achilles tendon in his knee, and your man went on and played for years and years and years afterwards, only because of David's brilliance did players have any chance of playing.
Meanwhile, Gary Gillespie is being treated by Roy Evans on a hairdryer. This doesn't seem right, does it?
Best team in the country, and that's staggering, isn't it?
That was the mindset, though, that you were no good to the manager if you were injured, and the theory was that you didn't want to be injured too long. But you know, I think looking back on it, I mean, nobody would understand that nowadays. Yeah. The amount of sports science people they have at football clubs is staggering these days. But certainly, we didn't have a qualified physio in our books.
Listen, so let me get this right then. Again, before we come on to the match, the fact that Ian was injured means that you played, I guess, up front on your own in a kind of very modern 4-5-1.
We did man to man.
Yeah. Steve had devised that what he wanted to do, and he said that I'll play up front on my own. And listen, Steve's theory was that if we're one or two goals in it at half time, we have a chance. And we put all our emphasis on set pieces. We had to try and win corners and free kicks to put Liverpool under pressure set pieces, because that was our strength. You know, we said Liverpool will have the ball and keep possession like Liverpool do. That's the only way they can play. What we have to do is, when we get it, we have to make a maximum impact and work on our set pieces. So we had Andy Gray with his delivery, and Gary touched on it. He's as good as anyone in the country at delivering the ball. He had a great shot.
Phil Barber,
great pass. Phil Barber as well, whipping into the net. So anyway, that was our
theme. In the build-up to the game, a few days beforehand, we were doing shadow play. We were playing against the reserves. And to his credit, we had Gary Thompson, the former Watford, Coventry, West Brom striker, in the squad, but ineligible to play. So he was working so hard to give us a hard time in practices and all sorts of things. And you're thinking, we're coping this. Everything looked good. The whole shape of our setup was good.
But with all due respect to Gary, he is not Ian Rush and Peter Beardsley.
However, when you're playing and you're feeling the shape is right and the pattern's there and everybody's moving in the way that you need and want them to move, that was brilliant. And then you get a kind of sense of...
Did you mark Rush and Richard Shaw marked Beardsley?
Yeah.
And was it Pemba with Barnsley? Barnes? Something like that.
Yeah, because John would have started the semi-final in a wider position, and my intervention on Ian Rush's ribs caused the change in that setup.
We'll talk about your contribution to Ian Rush's performance in a little while. As we've been hearing, the game in 1990 was in a tremendous state of flux. It's very old-fashioned in many ways, Gary Gillespie and his various treatments there at Liverpool, but it's also coming into the modern world, and the semi-finals are an example of that, because they split the two semi-finals for the first time ever.
Yep.
They didn't kick off at the same time, and also I think they're both live on television for the first time ever, which means that you three were part of teams who had to kick off at midday, which is an unusual occurrence, and I wonder if it means that you've got no time to really build up to the game. You just have your breakfast and go and play, I suppose, do you?
You don't get involved in lunch, you have a decent breakfast. But the build-up to the game, when we parked up in a hotel in Sully Hall, was interesting because...
With a moat,
of course, why not? Yeah. And we had to break into a school playing field the day before through the fences to get a practice match, to get some sort of practice going. Mm-hmm. And that was our intense, really scientific build-up to the first semi-final of the day.
I don't know how you, other Gary Gillespie, I don't know how you possibly lost to this show, but...
nor do we.
Did you stay in a hotel or did you drive down from Liverpool in the morning? You must have stayed in a hotel, I guess, Gary.
You know, I can't really remember.
Right,
I think we would actually just travel down on
just
the day.
Just another semi-final for Liverpool, isn't it?
Yeah, it was just another semi-final, possible trip to Wembley for the 16th time in that decade.
Yeah.
So, no, I think we just travelled down on the day, if I recall. I might be wrong about that. I'm sure somebody will phone in and let us know. But it was just another game. I think the morning kickoffs or the early kickoffs does throw you a little bit out of kilter. I think people that like a pre-match. I know Peter Bearsley, for every game, his pre-match meal was to get up early in the morning and have a full English breakfast. So he probably was okay. But the rest of the lads might have been like a little bit different. Well,
Gary, to be fair, Mark Bright makes the point that these morning kickoffs, which I always think are a bit slow to get going, when you've seen modern players playing them, he says it shouldn't be like that because you normally train at 10 o'clock in the morning anyway.
Yeah, well, but you're normally finished by 11:30, you see. That's the thing.
You're, yeah. you're in the bookmakers by one. Yeah,
you're normally knocking off by then.
I mean, my obviously you speak to family and friends and you know it's an early kickoff and it's unique because you're making history in terms of it's the first pair of live kickoffs, both games on the same day, different split times, 12 and 4, I think. Yeah. And speaking to a friend of mine that morning, he just said... just fancy everyone's going to see you live get beat 9.
You sure that was a friend?
Yeah.
I mean, there is a mindset issue here as well. I'm sure Steve Coppell would have pointed this out to you. You know, for Liverpool, with all due respect, Gary, and you know that their professionalism meant it wouldn't have been a problem. It was another semi-final towards another final, presumably.
Yeah.
For Crystal Palace, they'd never reached a final of a major tournament before. They'd never won. I think they won a championship, you know,
Danny,
Division
it,
One.
But... it was the biggest game of every Crystal Palace player's life. It's that simple. For Liverpool, it wasn't, because it's just another game to get them to where they want to be.
Yes.
Where they've been before so many times.
And where they belong.
And
yeah,
they will continue
argue,
to
yeah.
go back to. Yeah.
This was crafts for us. We were mongrels, which we've already touched on. Well, that's the way I looked at it. But it was
you've
our chance.
You've got very wiry hair, Gary.
My tail is wagging, yeah. Stop not hanging that biscuit in front of my nose.
You're lucky to get a biscuit here, yeah, I promise you.
I guess that. Yeah. But I think for us, it was a case of like, we've got something. We were all motivated. We were players that maybe hadn't gone as far as we wanted to do in the early parts of our career. We had points to prove, and this was a wonderful stage. Yes, there was the intrepidation of facing what was probably the greatest club team at that moment in the world, but okay, we were here and we had every chance as them, as in our mindset, to achieve something.
Okay, well listen, next we'll be focusing on the game itself, which swings one way and then the other and then back again before Palace eventually win. I don't mind, it's not a spoiler, I'll give it away. It's 4-3 after extra time. Unbelievable game.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number 1 in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
So game time, guys. The first half, I guess we could have expected it, if not dominated by Liverpool. A lot of Liverpool possession and much of what you trained for, Gary O'Reilly, in the week running up to it.
Yeah, not seeing the ball a great deal.
You think,
where is Ian? Oh, he's the player that's running away from you right now. And, you know, you had Rashie to cope with. You've got John Barnes in support. You've got Bizzy. You've got McMahon. You've got some of the standout players in English football at this particular...
This
my apologies to Ray.
Team, yeah, no.
It's a phenomenal team.
He works with me here at TalkSport, and he would never forgive
me. And I do believe that I had a spasm in my right shoulder and my arm shoots up in the air.
Now, hang on. See, I want
Danny.
To warn all three of you that, of course, we can enjoy the banter and the exaggeration that's natural after nearly a quarter of a century. God bless us all. But I took the precaution last night of watching the game from start to finish. So any outright lying about your part in it will not be tolerated, OK?
OK, so...
Yeah. So
There's a phantom offside. I have a Tony Adams spasm in my right arm.
All right. Let's just remind us. Gary Gillespie, you were playing at right back, so you were probably seeing some of Mark Bright, and you, Gary O'Reilly, are playing in the middle of the defence for Palace with Mark playing up front on his own.
Yeah.
So the first goal, we've got to hear a lot of goals. Well, let's hear how it was commentated. Let's hear how it actually went. Ian Rush gives Liverpool the lead in what is a pretty steady and unremarkable by comparison to what was going to happen first half. All very matter of fact. I would make the point there that Steve McMahon lost the ball in midfield, Gary Gillespie, but Alan Pardew gave it back to him, which is very kind of him. And then Gary O'Reilly, the man you're marking, appears
in the penalty
area, apparently unmarked, because you're 15 yards away, waving your hand in the air, presumably at some relative you've seen in the crowd.
I didn't think he'd score. It was only
because he never does. Yeah,
it was only rushy. And then we're faced with the spectre of Ian scores, they don't lose.
Yeah, that's right.
And that was the mantra. So it was like,
But in all seriousness, Gary, I mean, you're watching the game yesterday. You kind of try and step out, and the ball gets played past you.
I've made a complete faux pas, I believe, the technical term. Yeah. Yes, and therefore we got what we deserved, or I got what we deserved, and these guys have had to pay for it along with me.
It's always the problem. I mean, I'm not a technician of the game, but McMahon has no pressure on the ball, so you can't be stepping forward. You've got to go backwards. That's the theory, Danny.
I have the seat next to you because given my action at that moment, I couldn't be accused of being a technician of the game.
No.
It was for me watching from stand up front of my own. When he went through, I thought, oh no, miss. And he scored, and you're already aware because all the papers tell you when Rush scores, Liverpool win. And
am I right in thinking at that stage he had never lost? They'd never lost a competitive game, and he scored he probably scored 250 goals by this stage.
No, that's not quite true.
Thank God.
It all changed in the League Cup final in '87 against Arsenal. We scored first, and Rushy scored, and then Charlie Nicholas popped up and scored two goals. So that wasn't quite the case, but if Rushy scored, we did normally win.
What are your recollections of the first half, Gary?
It was a kind of non-event, really. Yeah. I think we were talking earlier on about the morning kickoff or the early kickoff, and it was relatively subdued. It was a sunny day. The pitch was a bit bobbly, not great conditions, I have to say. But I think we kind of dominated possession, as you probably expect. And then Gary O'Reilly, man marking, gave up on that and tried to play offside. But then Rushy went off, didn't he? Went off after 30 minutes.
I had a part in. That.
Tell us about that, Gary. Did you ask him? Did you say, please, go off now?
No, but I did it in a way that I didn't quite stop as I went to close him down.
Right.
And I think he's...
Are you proud of this?
No, not of course not.
No.
No, there was no intention for me to injure Ian and get him out of the game. There's nothing along those lines.
It's not Wimbledon.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, and it was a collision, and Ian comes off worse with his ribs, as far as I'm aware. And
could you tell, from the way he was moving and running, that he wasn't right?
Oh, he wasn't moving. He was struggling. Right. And that then changes the dynamic of Liverpool's setup because they don't have... Because don't forget, in those days, there's
two
only
subs.
two subs. And they're
who
not...
Do they had
Steve Stone came on.
And Barry Venison would have been the other.
Yeah, yeah.
So
exactly.
they had some defensive players.
So now, their focal point is John Barnes. So now I don't have to worry about Ian Rush's pace going in behind.
Did John come and play centre forward?
He does. So therefore he's going to be playing in front of me. Therefore we can condense the pitch just a little bit more, put our midfield in contact with their midfield.
John's not slow, but he's no Ian Rush.
There were a few like Ian Rush.
Yeah.
And John's a supremely talented footballer at this time. But it was a different player to cope with, and we weren't worried too much about getting caught in behind. And so now this whole thing begins to change and starts to become more advantageous for us.
I can barely remember anything of the first half except for Rush scoring. I don't remember.
There's a short break.
Unless I'm involved, Gary. Yeah,
exactly.
But I don't remember having many touches. I just remember closing and running and chasing and trying to put the team under pressure, which I couldn't do on my own.
You'd have been running in between, Glenn Hussain and Alan Hansen. Yeah.
But when we got in at half time, I think the first thing I said to Coppola is, I haven't had a kick. He said, sit down, don't worry, keep calm. And then Everybody came. We all sat down, and he just said, "We're in it. We're involved. We are involved in this game." And he wanted us to. Well, we talked about the incident immediately after half time and the positivity of players be, you know, like John Pemberton.
Meanwhile, Gary Gillespie, in the Liverpool dressing room, there was rather more going on. You're 1-0 up, but not all the players, including yourself, are entirely fit.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was surprised. I played right back in the game, and John Salako was your wide left player. And I thought I was going to be in a little bit, you know, a one against one situation a lot more than what I was. But it never kind of panned out that way. But at half time, I did feel my groin go just before half time. And so at the half time interval, we're in the dressing room. I've got a problem with my groin. You know, so it's touch and go. Do I stay on or do I not stay on? And little be known to me, really, at the time, I think Ray Houghton was having a problem as well. Ray had missed a lot that season.
Ray had a back injury that started to flare up again.
Yeah. And he really was struggling. So it was, again, it was a little bit of a toss up. I wasn't really totally aware of this. But then the situation again, we talked about it earlier on about Aldo playing in that 9-0 game, and that was his last game. You know, that would have been the ideal substitute to come on for Rushy, striker for striker, but we didn't have that on the bench. We had Steve Staunton and we had Barry Venison. So in the end, I ended up coming off with the groin strain. Ray played on that right-hand side, and then Barry Venison came on as a right-back. Now, I think the build-up to the game, we knew that Crystal Palace would be good at set plays. We knew that we'd be put under pressure with any, you know, corners, free kicks. So the lack of height there with me going off probably played a big factor in that second half and the performance.
What a start to second half it was. Remarkable, because the following things happened. Liverpool kicked off, but Crystal Palace scored within 10, 11 seconds. And the goal, Mark Bright, is not a bad finish at all. Tell us some. I'll ask you to describe the goal, because you're the one who gets the goal. Well, what happened?
There was a bit of a mix-up on the left-hand side, I think, as John Pemberton picked the ball up, I think, just by the halfway line. And he just set off. And as Pembo does,
this is from Liverpool's kickoff, yeah.
Yeah, probably the quickest player on our side at that time. He went down the right, and you just knocked it, went again. So obviously you make your way into the box. The cross came over. I think Sulaco had a shot at the far post. It came back off somebody to me. I'd gone into the near post and fell over. I got back up again, and when it came back to me, I sort of hit a left foot volley, and I think Steve McMahon was on the line, and I think it just went off his foot. Touched the top of his head
but it appeared to be flying. If it hit him properly, it killed him, wouldn't it?
He just went back to the line to protect the goal, and I caught it. It was sweet, and you know, he rocketed in off his head, and virtually that was about my fourth or fifth touch in the game, because I wasn't involved in it. So my first touch in the second half went to the back of the net. We were back in it, and obviously right in front of the Holt end, which was a split, wasn't it, 50-50 with the fans. And you know, Pembo was virtually he'd carried on his run into the crowd.
From where I am, I've got a great view of it. Mark's involved in things that are beginning to develop. When Pembo goes on that run, we know how quick he is. The guys in the stadium, it's one of those moments where they go, "Oh my God, look at that." And he's just cartoon quick. He just goes off. And then I think if you look now and again, there's a challenge takes place in a game that galvanises a team or gets the fans excited and invigorated. That was it. That moment when John goes off and a goal comes on the back of it, Palace fans are saying,
"We're in it.
We've actually, let alone get beaten up, we've scored."
Gary Gillespie, as you say, suddenly with the substitution that had been made, including your own disappearance, when that cross comes in from from John Pemberton, nobody from Liverpool attacks the ball. They're lacking height, aren't they?
Well, I never actually saw it. I was still in the treatment room. I was in the dressing room getting treatment from the physio who was on the bench, so I wasn't getting treatment from any physio. I was just doing it myself.
Did you have the wax boot with you?
No, I was literally sat on the bench with a bag of ice. So I did, you know, I watched it. I have watched it since then. And, you know, I think Pemberton, you know, he is quick. I think he ran past David Burrows, who was no slouch. And then Ronnie Whelan tried to get over
different
and cover.
No,
Ronnie isn't the quickest, I have to say that. But then the ball flying to the back post, and I think Barry Venison does exceptionally well. He's come on for me, gets a header, and then the ball eventually falls to Brighty. And I have to say, as much as it hurts me, it was a quality finish.
Thank you very much, Gary.
And that was the kind of game changer, I think, because as Gary rightly says, it gave them the momentum that they needed. Had the game gone maybe another 5, 10, 15 minutes or something like that, then we'd probably got into into our routine or into our passing the play to try and keep the ball, make passes, and the game might have passed, you know, Palace by. But that certainly gave them the impetus. And after that, you know, when I came out watching the second half, it was kind of backs to the wall for long periods of that second half.
Particularly with Crystal Palace and the set pieces they were getting, which were causing lots of trouble from my viewing of the game last night. Well, listen, let's talk to somebody else who was on the pitch at that time and for the remarkable events of the next hour or so. Of course, he's a great friend of the station and I think a very brave man, because I've already made him sit through the whole of the 1988 FA Cup final. It's a good friend, Ray Houghton. Hello, Ray.
How are you, boys?
Very good. Hey, thanks for joining us. Congratulations, Ray. You're a very brave fella. You're always prepared to put up with the adversity as well as the triumphs. Now, we talked about the half-time discussion about your own injury. How badly hurt were you playing out on the right-hand side for Liverpool, Ray?
Well, I think it was a toss-up between Gary and I who were going to come off. I mean, who was the worst was going to stay off? Gary won that one, as he normally did.
Well, he's telling us that's because they had no physio at Liverpool. No wonder you weren't fit.
No, we didn't have a video. The physio, should I say. Yeah, it was Roy Evans that used to look after, believe it or not. I mean, gone are the days. That's all changed now, thankfully. But, it's Gary. I was just listening to Gary. Very interested. Very happy to put his own ice on. Well, that was a recurring theme throughout my 5 years at Liverpool. Where very much you treated yourself, particularly in the mornings before...
Gary Gillespie was describing some kind of weird wax-melting machine they had as well.
Well, we had lots of machines. Unfortunately, Danny, a lot of them didn't work. It was only when we had a good electrician that came out, we realised that some of them had been broken for years, and we'd been sitting there like fools for 10, 15 minutes at a time thinking this machine was getting us better, when obviously it wasn't even working. But, there were some crazy days. But talking about the game itself, I certainly felt that the way that Palace came out for the second half, you obviously... Stevie Cotwood said a few words to them at half-time. I think along the line, get stuck into them. Let's put Liverpool on the back foot, because the first half, apart from Rush's goal, not a great deal happened.
No.
You know, we didn't have many chances. They didn't have many chances. And really, you know, we were there. I think we were there for the taking. I thought we looked a bit tired going into the game. We had a couple of injuries during the first half, where Gary went off at half-time, Rushy went off. So we used up both our substitutes. And we had to change a lot around. You know, Barnsley went up front. Stevie Staunton played on the left-hand side of midfield. Barry Fenton came in his natural right-back position. But there's a few changes that we had to make.
And
the way that they started, Danny, in the second half was brilliant. Pemberton's run, the crossing, and Brighty. What a fantastic finish. And, you know, got them right back into it.
But, guys, after 70 minutes, while we might have expected a fantastic finish from Mark Bright, because that's what he's made his career doing, we then have the second major contribution of the game from Gary O'Reilly, having waved Ian Wright through for the opening goal
of the game.
Yeah.
In Rush,
who knew? Sorry, Ian Rush, beg your pardon. Who knew that this was going to happen? Are they in front? You couldn't believe that. No one can believe it.
The temerity to go in front against Liverpool.
And you've got to remind us, tell us about the goal, Gary.
It's all of about 6 yards out, if less, probably not even that far. And then I'm thinking...
But again, the ball's bounced down from another cross into
dropped,
Liverpool area.
And I think the great thing that we'd worked out is containment from set plays. It's maybe not the first phase, it's the second phase. We had what we called the umbrella around the outside of the 18-yard area. If you think about that arc, we'd post players on there to contain any ball that came out. And if it was scrappy and it was falling, we were proactive in making something happen out of it. And I was lucky. I didn't have to think about it. It fell in front of me. I just struck it. I mean, normally it's endangering the corner flag rather than the back of the net. But on this occasion, I got lucky.
Yeah, the linesman is ducking. Yeah, yeah. It comes well. No, fantastic.
I think Gary might be still the only centre-back who scored in a semi-final and a final of the FA Cup.
Well, we'll hear about
in the same season.
The show,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah.
I mean, but one thing I will say to Ray Houghton and to Gary Gillespie, that Liverpool team, which Ray, you know, I hold in the absolutely the highest possible esteem, that particular Liverpool team of 88, 89, 90, that might have been enough in a semi-final to put other teams off their dinner. But of course, Liverpool not like that, are they? And so you will have, I don't know how you did it, but you will have gathered yourself then to make a comeback.
Well, we dug in, Danny. That's what we had to do. I mean, if we didn't, I think there was a chance that Palace might have run away with that stage because their confidence had soared from the first goal from Mark. You know, as soon as they got back to 1-1, you could see there was a confidence about them, a belief about them. You know, I heard Gary talking earlier about the momentum that they got, and I think that was hugely important for them. And at that stage, they were the better team. But, you know, great sides and, you know, teams that have done it in the past at Liverpool, you know, they dig in and they find a way of producing moments that get you back into games. And we've done that. We got it back to 2-2, and then 3-2 up. Seven minutes to go.
Well, what happens in the last 10 minutes? I mean, it's easy to talk about, you know, the most astonishing this and the most astonishing that, but it is a very, even by the standards of football, you know, it is an astonishing last 10 minutes of the game. From being 2-1 down, Liverpool turn it around, a penalty. Steve, remind me, how did the penalty go, Gary? Was John Pembo?
It's John Pembo. Yeah. And Pembo is still not convinced
Stevie
it was.
Stevie Stone, wasn't he? Broke into the box, and Pemberton. Give credit to Stevie, because he cuts across John Pemberton, and it's basically a coming together of legs. You see it so often these days. You didn't see it so often back in the good old days.
But George Courtney was in a great position, though. He was very close to it.
It was a stonewall penalty, to be honest with you.
And John Pemberton would argue with you, but I think he'd lose it, but he'd argue with you anyway.
There wasn't many arguments about the penalty, I think we just accepted that. I mean,
I think Andy Gray tries to do a number on George Courtney. I think at one stage he actually embraces the referee and tries to whisper in his ear.
Put Barnsley off taking it, isn't he?
Well, and John Barnes scores the equaliser. That's after 81 minutes to make it 2-2. It's already a great game by this stage. And then, Ray Houghton, you take the lead 2 minutes later.
Yeah, we did. Yeah, we went 3-2 up, Danny, and great credit to us.
Can you remember that goal?
I can't remember the goals.
No, I think the penalty was the goal to take us 3-2 up. The first one was a free kick down the right-hand side.
Yes.
And
was it Macca?
What happened was Steve Staunton and Barry Venison were over the ball, and we all thought it was going to go across, and Steve slips Barry Venison down the outside of the wall. He pings it across first time, and it falls to Steve McMahon on the edge of the box, and he smashes it into the top corner. Yeah. That was the goal to get us on level terms. And Barnes's penalty was the one to take us to 3-2,
and it should have been the one that takes you to Wembley, because that's the way the world works, except that with 2 minutes to go, Crystal Palace get their equaliser. It was a scrappy equaliser, but it doesn't matter, does it?
Did it come back off McMahon's chest and Andy...
Did you get an assist in there? I think Mottram was trying to give you an assist.
I think Bruce Grobbelaar came out to try and punch, and I think I just kind of jumped in his way. I'm sure of that. Gary might know.
But I think it does pop up. But what you've got, what you get the sense of, is we swarmed.
Yes,
we swarmed into the box, and you hear about people that got to get numbers in the box, and we were there. We came in numbers. There was no reverse in the gearbox, Danny. I mean, you talk about the character that Liverpool had.
I think, and
rightly so, their character of champions. But we had this kind of naivety that don't have a reverse in the gearbox, so why look for it?
You could hear the commentary. It said 3 minutes to go, so obviously you throw everybody in there, and what you're hoping for is a break. You remember Gary's gone off, he's obviously 6 foot plus, and we just get everybody in and around the guys who are attacking the ball for the pieces, as we call them.
I mean, that's 3-3. The extraordinary thing is that, we're going to talk about extra time in a second, but you almost won it. I mean, Ray Houghton, again, because you're here with me, I mean, am I right in thinking that Palace hit the crossbar then between 3-3 and the final whistle?
Yeah, I think it was Andy Thorne that had the chance. Andy hit the crossbar. And I could have won it for them. You know, that's how football changes. You know, it was amazing how you can come back and you feel that it's yours for the taking. You're 3-2 up, 3 minutes to go. I think with that goal as well, if my memory serves me right, it was where I think the three of the lads had pushed up, and Glenn Hussein had dropped off and played a few of the Palace boys onside, and from there they kept the ball alive in the box, and that's where it got them.
As Gary O'Reilly was explaining what they did,
and then you've got the opportunity for Thorny when he hits the crossbar.
Whoa.
And then when we get into extra time, I've got to say, you know, they were in the ascendancy. Palace looked the more likely, the more threatening. And it's amazing how many times you come back from adversity. But I just think it was one step too far from us. You know, being 2-1 down, we showed our resolve and our guts and determination to get 3-2. But then, fair play to Palace, they came back to 3-3. And certainly the momentum was with them at that stage.
Well, Ray, I'll spare you the agony of that extra time, because that's what we'll be talking about next, after that incredible second half with the game level at 3-3. The match goes into an extra 30 minutes. And let's be joined by somebody else who wore the Crystal Palace shirt that day. Jeff Thomas is on the line now as well. Hello, Jeff.
How are you doing?
Very good indeed. Listen, we've talked through the actual match where, of course, you've been written out of it by Brighton and O'Reilly. Apparently, it was all about how brilliant they were. And the Palace midfield did nothing that day. Tell us, allow you, Jeff, just to get... Football fans are always fascinated by what happens in that talk before the extra time starts. Can you remember the atmosphere among yourself and the fellow Palace players and Steve Coppell?
Well, I just remember that the game was going backwards and forwards, and I think With us getting the equaliser just before the 90 minutes were up, I think we had the momentum going forward, and we were very positive, and our fitness levels were at such a level that we felt confident we could do it in extra time.
And what about yourself? I mean, despite what these two have been saying, I presume you are pretty tired yourself, because it was an amazing, particularly the second half, was an amazing game to play in.
Yeah, it was, and but I think because a lot of the guys, I think there was only Andy Thorne out of our 11 who'd ever experienced Wembley, and I think the carrot was too big for us to feel tired. And I think the Liverpool guys, you know, fantastic team. They've all experienced bigger occasions than that one, and it was we got wrapped up in it all, and rather than sort of being scared by it, we really sort of rose to the occasion. And you know, the extra time from my memory, I think we dominated it.
Okay, well, listen, at the risk of upsetting Gary Gillespie, but of course he was off the pitch this time, so he's not going to get the blame for it at least. The goal comes after 109 minutes, and it is the now very famous and busy Alan Pardew who gets the goal. I was going to say, Gary Gillespie, another headed touch in your penalty area. They were missing you.
Yeah, I think if you were to look at it nowadays, you know, with the scrutiny that's put on with Sky and things like that, and analyse it, you know, we would be absolutely lambasted the way we defended the near post corner. And all credit to Crystal Palace. I think we knew going into the game, as I said before, that we would be under pressure from set plays, and certainly that was the way it proved. I think all credit to Andy Thorne. It was a great near post.
I was going to say, watching the game yesterday, as I was, it's out of fashion now, that corner to the near post with a centre-half or a striker heading it on. Because, of course, once it's had that first touch, it's then impossible to defend. You all know that, Gary. Well, but people don't do it anymore.
Well, the guys were talking about earlier on, you know, second balls, it's always difficult. To defend second balls. Yeah, and it used to be a regular occurrence that, you know, the big centre back or your centre forward would be the one to get to the near post, get the flick on, and then everybody piling in at the back, and that's how you actually got the goal. I think Andy Thorne's, you know, header in normal time was probably the best opportunity, the best chance that Palace had, and he rocketed it against the crossbar. But all in all, I think we were a little bit dead in our feet.
Yeah.
And I think Jeff makes a good point that, you know, it was probably Palace wanted it that little bit more. It meant a little bit more to them to get to a Wembley Cup final than maybe what it did to the Liverpool lads. And you don't think that at the time, but when you look back on it, you know, 23 years down the line, and you watch it again, that might have just been the case that we'd been there twice that season already. We'd played in the Charity Shield. I think we played a tournament in Makita tournament. Yeah. I think at the pre-season. And in past seasons, we were regular visitors to Wembley. So, I think it was a bigger occasion for the Palace guys than maybe what it was for the Liverpool lads.
Of course, on the day, you don't feel that, Gary.
No, you don't.
But looking back on it, you can make some kind of suggestion of that. Let's say we get through to the final whistle then, and the celebrations, the pile of Crystal Palace. Sorry, Gary, I'm counting you out this. Yeah. let me start with Jeff Thomas. Jeff, where were you in the pile of Crystal Palace players? I mean, it just comes to a giant haystack of Palace players on top of each other.
I think I was right in the middle of it. Yeah. I mean, first of all, as captain of the side, I felt I had to go around all the Liverpool players.
Did you manage to shake hands, yeah?
Yeah, I tried to. But, you know, you really wrapped up in it all, and the excitement of...
The exception, of course, is Steve Coppell, who goes very remarkably quickly down the tunnel, not looking left or right. He just
left it for the players. He thought it was their moment. And I can remember Wrighty hobbling off the bench with his plaster on and his long overcoat, racing on to sort of embrace and...
Surprised
not
he didn't
knowing,
come on during the game.
Yeah, not knowing quite what to do. Do you go shake hands with the opposition? Do you celebrate yourself? And it was one of those really strange moments. And then we ran towards, the whole tent, isn't it?
Yeah.
And just celebrated in front of it. And that's where the pile-on began. And I don't know. I think at that moment there... Like the realisation that, you know, we'd made it through to the FA Cup final. It was like against the best team in the country. One of the best teams in the world.
Yeah,
I remember. It was magical.
I remember the Liverpool players showing class because this is their double gone.
Yep.
This is their opportunity for a double gone. And they didn't shirk the handshake. They didn't shirk with best wishes. They didn't shirk with congratulations. And then when we were at the Holt End, the one thing I will never forget, Liverpool fans, give us this bunch of... raggedy mongrels, a standing ovation. Now, they know what's just gone out the window, yet they had the class, because they're some of the most educated, passionate, knowledgeable football fans around.
I mean, do you know what? I wonder, with the partisanship that's been stoked up by the money and the television coverage, whether you still get the same thing today, because football fans are now, we're all conditioned to, it's either win or bust, but they must have known they saw something remarkable that day. They saw an amazing game of football.
I think if you took the same scenario to Liverpool fans today, I got a feeling they'd do the same.
Yeah, I hope so too. Listen, thank you very much indeed, Jeff.
And the
captain of the team, of course, and we're heading into the home straight to this edition of My Sporting Life. Let's talk about Glad All Over, guys, because this was back in the days when teams still made FA Cup records, whether we liked them or not.
Musical stylings of the Crystal Palace 1990.
Did you actually sing on it, or did they bring in a load of...
We recorded that at the Abbey Road Studios.
Lovely.
Excuse me.
Eric Monsterhall was our agent, and we had the best day doing that. They've never heard voices like ours.
No, and they never will. No. And we, the four goal scorers from the semi-final, because it's Abbey Road, Dan, you know where this is headed.
Go on. You're photographed on the zebra crossing.
That was on the cover.
That was on the
cover of the record.
So no matter who...
Who was wearing those shoes?
Yes.
You?
No. Silly, never got
that. Do you
know
what? I've got the original copy.
I think I might have one somewhere. But when I speak to people in the music business... You know, I actually did record at Abbey Road.
Well, it's very good.
And it just
shameful.
For a second, you put them on the back foot.
The two of you, just a second ago, when we were off air, were arguing about the meaning for the Crystal Palace players of being in an FA Cup final.
Yeah.
Because Gary had been at a club at Spurs, who had beat a lot of cup finals, a traditional team.
Yeah.
You'd, in fact, been in the squad for the 81 or 82 final. And played at Wembley in the Charity Shield.
I played at Wembley in the old Charity Shield, so I had a taste of what was going on. But
Mark made the point. This was beyond the expectations of Crystal Palace Football Club.
Absolutely, because when you play for Spurs, Manchester United, they go there year after year after year. They always get back. When you're at Crystal Palace and you've got a chance of playing in the FA Cup final, it might be your only chance. So it meant more to the players, to the fans, to the club, to everyone concerned. So while Gary's had the experience of being at the big club and being involved in it, for us it was something that it was schoolboy dreams. It really was, because I explained the day as it was magical, because to come back down the motorway to the
birth of your firstborn.
Yes, because you can't. It's very difficult when people ask you how it feels.
Yeah,
ask the fans how it feels. How did they feel beating Liverpool that day? They were looking up. People still say to you on Twitter and everything, it was the best day of my life, best day of my life. No, it's not the best day of your life. The best sporting day, maybe.
Yes.
But, you know, when I had my child, my son, I thought, I know what it feels like. I can't quite explain how great this feels.
No, it's not four words. These experiences are not four words. This is what, a contradiction as given what we're doing. But
yes.
It's for the mind, the heart.
You come out at Villa Park on this 12 o'clock kickoff, and all of a sudden, the balloons go up. You are chilled. You are in some... It's never happened before. It's happened since, but never in that way. And I think all of a sudden, they set the first page in glorious red and blue.
The final at Wembley is the first one where everyone was sat down. I don't know if you know that. It was the first all-seater final.
Wow. I don't think everybody sat down.
That's why the crowd was reduced.
Do Crystal Palace have 40,000 fans to fill one end of Wembley? Apparently so. Yes. So,
and plenty more.
Well, the split was there was loads of arguments over tickets, Danny. It was like 25, 25, 25, and then the rest.
Yeah.
As you know, the FA, if you're affiliated with the FA, you get tickets sent. So there's always the argument
about
tickets.
The annual farce,
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, walking out, I would say, from that tunnel, you know, that you've watched every year, walking out over the sort of the sand, the you've got the little sort of like...
carpet over that kind of running track. And, the dog track, wasn't it?
And the balloons are all going up, as Gary said, and the noise and... I don't know. I think you're bursting with pride. I mean, you look and you see Manchester United. They've been there before. They've seen it.
To be fair, this wasn't a great Manchester United team, though. I think you had a better chance in that final.
You name some individuals. All right, Robson,
sure.
Ince, Parker,
Hughes.
As Gary,
Bruce,
but as Gary pointed out, they finished in the bottom half of the table.
I know, but you look at that team, and on paper,
the basis
that's not bad.
And the 1990 FA Cup is a particularly amazing tournament, because the same day that you beat Liverpool 4-3, there was a 3-3 semi final between Manchester United and Oldham. Another amazing game.
Correct.
Yes.
And this final at Wembley, which is not the subject of our talk tonight, but just remind people to forget, this also ended 3-3. This game, and Gary O'Reilly, you became the first and no doubt only defender to have scored in the semi-final and the final when you opened the scoring.
Yeah, I did. And my recollection is I get the ball out on the edge of my own 18-yard area. Yeah. Or it hits me on the back of the head, and Paul Ince recently came up to me and said, "Are you still claiming that?" But yes, I am, because I don't believe Paul...
I don't see Alan Shearer or Gary Lineker disowning any of their goals.
No,
why should you?
No, that was the way I looked at it. Yeah. I used to drive past Wembley Stadium on the North Circular as a child, going to visit relatives in Ealing, and thinking, I've got to play there. Mm. It's the FA Cup final. And for that, for my generation, the FA Cup final was probably, apart from an international, the only full-length live televised game
Correct.
You would see. And as far as romance goes, to play is one thing. To score, well, that is every childhood dream in one go.
I mean, just to remind people, Gary gave you the lead. Mm-hmm. Brian Robson and Mark Hughes put Manchester United ahead. Ian Wright came on as a substitute.
Going back to Wrighty, we'd played like three games, like the quarterfinal, semi-final, the quarterfinal and the semi-final without Ian, and now we're in the final, and Steve Coppell has to break the news to him, I'm not starting you, you know.
Because he hadn't played with his broken leg.
No, he hadn't. He had to play in a reserve game or something to prove his fitness, and Steve promised him because of what it meant to him and what he'd done for the club. Our best player was missing. There's no question about it. Ian was our best player.
Yeah.
You know, so he was on the bench and everyone felt for him, you know, Gary, there's a moment, isn't there, when the manager names the team for the semi or the final, where the people who are not in it, it's heartbreaking. And the manager says to you, focus on the task ahead. Now, they used to name it on the day sometimes, but usually the day before. Yeah. And it's so upsetting. People like Eddie McGoldrick, who had been brilliant for Palace, he'd not got an ankle injury, he couldn't get himself fit. And anyway, so Ian Wright's on the bench. And anyway, Coppell sends him on. As he promised, you will get on that final, regardless of the score. And he came on, he looked at him, we nodded. The ball, Richard Shaw, I think, pumped the ball forward. I flicked it, he got hold of it, cut inside of Bruce and curled it past
Jim Leighton.
Now, if you're talking about fairy tale, it doesn't get better than that. So even talking about it right now, I feel a little chill where we raced as one down the touchline to jump on Wrighty because his dream had come true and virtually, so we're back in the game.
That made it 2-2. It goes to extra time. Ian scores again, but very early in the extra time, which gives it a long time to hold out against good Manchester United team. And as I say, it was another marvellous game. Mark Hughes gets his equaliser.
Yeah,
despite your best efforts, no doubt.
I got there as soon as I could.
Yeah.
And as strikers now inform me, they practice shooting between the legs of defenders.
Yeah, absolutely, they do.
And that's where it goes through.
Because that gives the goalkeeper no chance, doesn't it? Yeah. He can't allow for that.
There was a deflection for one of the Hughes goals, the first goal he gets, and then this one at the end. It's heartbreaking because when I see fans, 7 minutes, you know.
Seven minutes,
you know. And they're looking at me and I'm thinking, if I could do it, I would. But you're that close.
It's a game, not an exhibition. That's why we pay to watch it, isn't it?
We talked earlier about the element of surprise or whatever and you having your FA Cup experience.
Yeah.
For us, I think in our hearts we knew the day today to lift that cup was on the day.
Yes.
Once it went to the replay, I think the momentum swings in terms of the experience and the better team.
The replay, famously, Sir Alex Ferguson was unhappy with Jim Leighton's performance in the goal for Manchester United. He changed the team. Les Seeley comes in.
Yes.
And the game is an anti-climax, isn't it?
Absolutely.
The replay.
It is. We turn out looking like Borussia Dortmund. In yellow and black stripes, which I think...
You looked like, but did not play like Borussia Dortmund.
We were terrible.
Yes.
Terrible,
really? You would go as bad as that?
We did not give a performance of which we've been discussing in the last hour or so at Villa Park or in the first game.
It was aggressive. It was aggressive. It was nasty. It was. I just think we thought we could bully Man United a little bit. The idea was to put Jim Leighton under lots of pressure with crosses.
Let's see.
Hold on a minute. When the team sheet came in, and they said,
"Oh right,
Leighton's dropped." And let's see, we were staggered. I was thinking, "Wow, you dropped
him.
This is your
reason why Alex Ferguson is what he is." You know,
correct. This is for him. This is a defining moment in his career.
Mm. Yeah,
you know, because let's be honest, if they don't win the FA Cup, would he be there now?
Would he get? This is his first trophy for that, wouldn't he?
This is Sir Alex's first trophy.
Yeah.
The season after they win the European Cup Winners' Cup. Yeah. So I'm going to write a book called Sir Alex: My Part in His Success, paraphrasing the great Spike Milligan. But I don't think it's going to sell well.
Well, you do lose the final. I mean, we should say because the
Lee Martin
is he lost to history, Lee? A little bit, isn't he?
Neil Webb hit a long diagonal pass. Andy Gray watched it go over his head, then sprinted after Lee Martin. By that time, he took a touch on the chest and volleyed it in. I've got to say to you, I can never watch the TV when Brian Robson lifts the cup. even now, we're talking 20, if I see it coming, I turn away. And I don't know, that's how it's.
No,
it hurts.
You should. Quite
it
right.
It hurts.
Yeah.
That you had a great opportunity and you didn't grasp the opportunity.
Oddly enough,
or it wasn't meant to be.
Oddly enough, that summer they also announced they were lifting the embargo against English clubs playing in Europe.
Correct.
So Crystal Palace come like they could have won a trophy and could have qualified for Europe, and they've never got anywhere near it since. So you will tell me.
Oh, I don't know. The next season, Danny.
You did the
in
you
the
came
league.
Third.
We
finished absolutely.
Third.
Yes, that, sorry,
that was when the embargo was lifted.
I'll take it all back.
Yeah, we improved as a team. Don't forget, in that cup final year, Gary, we flitted with danger of getting relegated. We virtually never left.
Fifth from bottom.
We never left the bottom part of the table, you know, and the unique sort of like team spirit and atmosphere and never say die attitude never left the squad.
Do you know who I feel sorry for now? The losers at Wembley. It was bad enough then when you went up those 30 odd steps. Now they're climbing. It takes like 10 minutes to climb to get your losers medal. That's cruel and unusual.
It's proven that the way they do the Champions League final on the pitch,
much better.
It works. Yeah. It's better.
It's better for the crowd.
And I tell you one thing, Danny. When I get my medal,
mm-hmm.
and after the replay, and I turn it round and it says runners
up,
that.
That it does.
That
I don't even have.
I've never felt pain like that as a footballer, apart from the physical aspect of it. The runners up. That really cut deep.
But you know what, Gary? In last year, obviously, we had the Olympics and everything. I'd like to look at it as a silver medal. All the people who took part in the event, it came down to the last two. We got a silver medal.
You're going to have to spend a lot of time with me to sell you're still a winner, Gary. But we'll do it one day.
In actual fact, we shouldn't dwell on this because we were here to celebrate the semi-final. But of course, and you're right, though, you're professional people. And I'm sure Steve Coppell would have said, you know, there's no point in getting to an FA Cup final if you don't win the thing. Although I think 23 years later, and despite the words runners up on the back of your medal, better to have been there. Better to have loved that final loss than to have not been there at all. Daft question first, because it's obvious. Are you surprised then? This game, for anyone who, of a certain age, has stuck in the mind of people.
Yeah.
Are you surprised at that semi-final? It has such a place in people's hearts, doesn't it?
Well, you're thinking this is the first time you've...
Sorry, people say, oh, no one remembers the semi-finals. It's only a bit... Yeah, this game,
different era. Different era, Danny, because the first time they'd done the FA Cup finals live... Both on the same day, obviously a few hours apart.
Mm-hmm.
And people sat down to watch a live footballing event, which was obviously used to be the final. So I think the next day, I mean, I can remember coming back. We came back with a friend and Wrighty and Mitchell Thomas in this car, and kind of like we were just driving down the motorway.
Oh, Mitchell Thomas
Mitchell Thomas is all around us, and Wrighty was standing up through the sunroof because the traffic going back to London, Gary, can remember, nothing was moving, just trickling along. People getting out the cars, running over. Could you sign this? You know, I don't know. It was magical, but. I can't remember the question.
No, just I think you're surprised that people outside of Crystal Palace fans are so aware of this game. Yes.
I think from 23 years on, I think, wow.
Yeah.
It touched you that deeply. I think it's the high noon. It's the threads of the story that you've touched on.
Correct.
That Crystal Palace had just been promoted. They get hammered 9-0 at Anfield. They've got absolutely no chance. And somewhere along the line, the romance surfaces, and we are the vehicle to take it forward. And I think it touched people like that. The balloons, the visual aspect of the balloons going up as they did at Villa Park,
it was colourful.
Touched it. Got put and went, wow, you can do this at a game. There was theatre, there was real drama, and as you've touched on, it was a slow read to begin with, but boy, didn't it pick up.
It accelerated, it did, yeah. If it'd been a book, you might have put it to one side, but you don't get that choice
exactly,
in football, do you?
It was a David and Goliath thing, though, because of where we were as a club. We were struggling to survive in the top flight, and Liverpool were moving towards winning the league that time, which, ironically, well, incredibly...
Bizarrely.
They've never won since, so... You know, that's how great a team they were. And you touched on how successful they've been the sort of previous 16 years. Immense. So us just got promotion into the top flight, mixing it with the big boys. And then we get to the FA Cup semi-final. We play the best team in the country. So
probably in the world at the time.
And I think most people... plug for the underdog as well. So they're probably going, oh, go
well,
on.
Well, we were big in Manchester on the semi-final, and then maybe in Liverpool we picked up
a few
supporters.
Yeah, you were big in the Happy Mondays at one stage there in Manchester. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah.
Listen, guys, and finally, because we're running out of time, I'm sorry to say, just a memory each of the... when you... Because you're asked to talk about this all the time, I know you are, and it comes round every year. one thing, Gary, and one thing, Mark, that's stuck in your mind about that day or that run? Something that's personal to you that you think, wow, that's what that, the thing that when you wake up that comes in your mind about it.
Well, that's a dream come true.
Yeah.
I've scored in a
cup
final.
You did.
And you'll see from my celebration, which is arms straight up in the air and thinking, how do I celebrate? I'm not used to this.
No.
Fantastic.
I think the semi-final was magical for every reason, but to walk out at Wembley for the final and just the pride you feel, knowing all your family there and everything, I think even this far further, you know, moving forward, it's still thinking, reflecting, but looking back, it is a dream come true to play in the FA Cup final still.
You've been listening to an archive edition of Talk Sport's My Sporting Life with Danny Kelly. Thanks for listening, and make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Acast and Spotify for more top Talk Sport content.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.